number one ranks. A number one rank is a company that I believe is selling at half of liquidation value, where I believe that there's a probability, not a possibility, that they will double net asset value in 18 months, and where I believe that they have the opportunity to go to 10 for one in 5 years. That's a very, very, very rare setup. Tier twos or two ranks are also very rare. I believe I've awarded 60 or 70 twos in that time frame. Threes, a three is a solid buy. And I need to say that a five, a neutral for me is okay to hold if there's some optionality to commodities and if that commodity is out of favor.
Hey guys, this is Andy. I'm going to be at the Rule Symposium in July in Boca Raton. If you're already going, please stop by and say hello. If you haven't bought your tickets yet, please use the link in the show notes below. I'll see you there. What's going on, Rick? How you doing?
Life is great, Andy. All kinds of news. The world seems to be unfolding, at least my world, the way it should. So, life is pleasant. I hope it is for you and your listeners.
Yeah, it's been really good. In fact, I wanted to mention our last talk did exceptionally well. And so I want to kind of lead with the same format. Let's talk about the macro, then we'll go into how you evaluate some of the different companies and some of the different metals. So what's your macro point of view? And I'll set this up. It seems like the Fed, and we don't know what the Fed's going to do per se, but they've come out recently as dovish, I would take that. And it seems to me like they're trying to support stock market as well as we're going into a very important election.
I think in our last interview, we talked a bit about the Fed. Because I'm part of starting a new bank, I've sort of cultivated contacts at the lower levels of the Fed, whom I spend some time with. And by the way, they're uniformly high quality people, which surprises me from a big government organization, but we'll leave that aside. And I would say that the institutional bias within the Fed is not to cut interest rates. The Fed believes that they're the only responsible arm of the U.S. government, that Congress and the president would spend us into oblivion. They're probably right. That notwithstanding, it would look as though the political pressures on them in an election year are overwhelming. So I suspect, despite the institutional bias of the Fed, that they may be forced to reduce the interest rate. I'm personally surprised by at least the statistical strength of the U.S. economy. That's not to suggest that all Americans are benefiting equally. I know that many, many, many people are suffering. But the economy itself has held up much better than I thought it would with a doubling of the nominal interest rates. The suspicion that the Fed is going to have to pivot, like they did at the end of 1975, I think is responsible for a lot of the strength in the gold price. If they lower nominal interest rates, it signals that politics is more important to them than the deterioration of the US dollar. And if that happens, the value proposition around the US dollar or the deteriorating value proposition around the US dollar and around US debt securities, I think will force a lot of people into gold. And I think the strength that you're seeing in precious metals markets has to do with that. By the way, if you hold gold in non-US dollar terms, you've been in a bull market for 5 or 6 years. The US dollar, as Doug Casey famously says, is absolutely the worst currency in the world, with the sole exception of every other currency. The fact that gold is doing well in US dollar terms, while the US dollar does well against everybody else, means that outside the US dollar, we've been in a bull market in precious metals for a while.
So it's interesting that you say that, and I would agree with you too, that this is the strength in gold and now silver really is really foreseeing a Fed rate cut, if you would. Would you also say that that is due to a lot of central bank buying?
Well, certainly the strength that we've seen in gold so far hasn't had very much to do with Western world retail. The strength that we've, I mean, in fact, the ETFs, the data would show us that until 2.5 weeks ago, retail in the United States and most of the Western world were sellers, selling the bullion-oriented ETFs, and all of the strength on the buy side would appear to have been from foreign central banks or, to a lesser degree, Chinese and Indian citizenry. It's important to note that the move that we've seen in gold thus far has more to do with the weaponization of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. dollar inadvertently perhaps forcing foreign governments to sell U.S. Treasury securities and transact outside the U.S. dollar and look for a medium of exchange that was simultaneously a store of value, which is to say gold. The very recent popularity in gold, I think, has to do with the view that institutional holders have that this central bank buying will likely now be joined by retail and family office buying in the West. If you overlay the traditional gold buyer on top of this new gold buyer, you set the stage for what could be a really surprisingly strong gold and then later silver bull market.
So what's interesting to me then is the strength in the physical product, if you would, but then there's just, there was a softness until recently. Well, I shouldn't even say softness. It was a bear market in the equities. So what I am interested in, what many of my viewers are interested in, is obviously playing that arbitrage, for lack of a better word. And there seems to me there are potential great opportunity in the mining shares, specifically the junior shares. When I last had you on, we talked about your evaluation process and what leads to a tier one level investment, if you would. If you could walk us through or walk me through what makes a tier two to five or tier two to six level investment for you, since that's where the vast majority, it seems like, of companies that you're interested in, that's where they lay.
Well, I should clear up the nomenclature. When I say tier one, I'm usually referring to a deposit.
Yeah, pardon me.
As opposed to an investment. And a tier one deposit is defined many ways. I define it as a deposit that has in situ recoverable reserves and resources at current commodity prices in excess of $10 billion U.S. dollars that will be in the top quartile in terms of return on capital employed and the bottom quartile in terms of all-in sustaining costs, but a return on capital employed at any rate that exceeds 25%. My ranking system is 1 through 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. I need to say, in 30 years of using that ranking system, actually 30 plus years, if my memory serves me well, I've only had 9 or 10 number one ranks. A number one rank is a company that I believe is selling at half of liquidation value, where I believe that there's a probability, not a possibility, that they will double net asset value in 18 months, and where I believe that they have the opportunity to go to 10 for one in 5 years. That's a very, very, very rare setup. Tier twos or two ranks are also very rare. I believe I've awarded 60 or 70 twos in that time frame. Threes, a three is a solid buy. And I need to say that a five, a neutral, for me, is okay to hold if there's some optionality to commodities and if that commodity is out of favor. You know, companies that in a normal circumstance I wouldn't have afforded a five, were they in the uranium business at $20 a pound uranium, I would have said, well, I think the price of uranium is going to 50 or 60. And I would have awarded that kind of company a five. So the rankings are nuanced. And I need to say that there isn't a one-size-fits-all. I will sometimes award a fairly speculative company a three, and that company might not be suitable for a dividend-style investor. Similarly, I might award a very large company, a BHP or an Exxon, a three or a four, while that company probably isn't as appropriate to a speculator as some other name. So it's important to know that the rankings really have to do with risk-adjusted internal rates of return. And my rankings reflect my own values and my own needs and the needs of the 80,000-person community at Rural Investment Media. One who looks at my ranking has to sort of take into consideration what it is I'm trying to do with the whole rankings thing and personalize it for their own goals, their own means, their own time frames.
Sure. Okay, then let's talk about you specifically then. Let's eliminate a two, because you just said that's probably given out 60 of those. It seems to me like the ballpark of your rankings would be anywhere from a 3 to a 6-ish. Would that be correct?
Yeah, let's give you, well, no, there's lots of 7s and 8s. If you look at the juniors, if I actually evaluated, if I had time and I had the staff to evaluate the junior company universe, the 3,000 junior company universe, probably 2,500 of them would inhabit 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. I have fewer 7s because I don't follow them.
Right.
I look at them and there isn't enough demand from my database that I follow them. And I see no reason to follow them because I see them as a waste of money. If I actually distributed my rankings across the length and breadth of the mining and oil and gas industry, the vast preponderance of grades would be 7 through 10 or 6 through 10. But I try not to follow those unless there's a really large amount of demand for information surrounding them.
Got it. Okay.
My coverage universe is about 800. And that 800 is predominantly concentrated in the 4 through 6 range.
Okay, got it. So how do we eliminate? I guess that's what I'm trying to look at. I want to eliminate 2,500 of these juniors. What is there anything red flag, glaring red flag that I need to look out for?
Yeah. Luck favors the trained observer. So is the CEO and or the board comprised of serially successful people? Or is this their maiden voyage? It doesn't mean that they're doomed to fail in their maiden voyage. It just means statistically that you have no business backing other people's maiden voyage. Let them learn the trade on their aunts and uncles' money, not your money.
Right.
And is the success that they've enjoyed related to the task at hand? If somebody says to you, Andy, I've been a success in gold mining, and that success has to do with the fact that they have operated a producing gold mine in 2-billion-year-old Archean terrain in French-speaking Quebec, but the task at hand is exploring rather than operating for copper gold porphyries in 15-million-year-old accreted terrain in Peru. While they may have been a success, the success is completely unrelated to the task at hand. It's like a proctologist approaching a dental problem. They may have been a success, but that success would lead to a bad taste in your mouth. Couldn't resist.
I guess we'd start with that. Just go to the LinkedIn page, I guess. That would be a place to start.
I think the company's website is the place to start.
Okay.
And viewing with them. The second thing is scale. What I've learned in my life is that many entrepreneurs and many speculators sucker for the story that says you're going to look for a small mine and you're going to use the cash flow from the small mine to grow without dilution and you're going to bootstrap BHP. That's a wonderful story. It doesn't work. I've watched it work 3 times in 50 years. If you're going to take big risks, you have to take big risks in search of big rewards. Specifically, there has to be a legitimate target that could encounter, and you think probably will encounter, a deposit with $2.5 billion in recoverable reserves and resources at today's commodity prices. Small mines have big risks and make you small money. Why would you do that? Yeah. The third is the plan. Exploration, company building, involves answering a series of unanswered questions. When I ask company CEOs to define for me their value creation thesis, how they came up with the thesis, what facts on the ground support the thesis, and the proposal to test the thesis. When I ask them, what's the most important unanswered question that you're trying to answer with this exploration program, fully 80% of the companies I ask that to don't have an answer. In other words, they don't have a plan. It's though as though they were proposing to walk from, say, Los Angeles to San Francisco. They had proper hiking boots. They had a nice backpack. They had water. But they were headed east. You can't get somewhere without a plan. Most of these people, I mean, the real unanswered question to them is, will they still be able to draw a salary 18 months from now? And while I understand the relevance of that question to them, it means nothing to me whatsoever. So the process of answering unanswered questions, the size of the prize, and the credibility of the people answering the question is important.
Well, if you would, let's get to some companies here, and let's start with some of the gold companies. Gold's been on a tear, and just wanted to give you just give some commentary and your ranking, if you would, to some of these names. West Red Lake, and just as a caveat, I'm also an investor in West Red Lake. What are your thoughts, and how would you rank them?
I'm a shareholder of West Red Lake. I'm delighted to say that I'm a shareholder by now a substantially lower price. West Red Lake is trying to consolidate mining properties in the legendary Red Lake Gold District of Ontario. They're doing this behind a friend of mine, Frank Giustra, who has successfully done it before. They bought an asset, a failed asset, the Madsen Mine, which destroyed a lot of capital by going into production too quickly. West Red Lake correctly understands that what this is a very advanced exploration project. And what they're going to do now is step back and answer the unanswered question. Is the Madsen property really a contiguous, continuous, high-grade gold project? They're going to drill it off on very tight centers so that they can compile a mine plan. The last management team, who are also friends of mine, employed the strategy, got a bunch, bet a hunch. You know, got a hunch, bet a bunch, pardon me. They pursued mining much like Rubicon did, also in that area, before they had enough data to do it. West Red Lake is doing it in a much more comprehensive, much more intelligent fashion. Will this work? I don't know. But they've asked themselves the relevant question, and they have proposed a way to test the thesis that is, I think, very efficient. So I'm a holder.
Got it. How about
Equinox?
Yes.
I mean, disclosing conflicts. I've known Ross Beaty and been successful with Ross Beaty for in excess of 40 years. I've invested in 14 Ross Beaty companies. 12 of them have given me 10-to-1 returns. So anything that has Ross Beaty attached to it is automatically attractive to me. Ross has a stated goal of building Equinox to a million-ounce producer. Which I think he's going to do. The stock has been clobbered, although it's done well in the last 3 months, but clobbered as a consequence both of some problems with existing producers, I would suggest, frankly, due to underinvestment in sustaining capital, but more importantly, due to their construction efforts in Ontario, where the industry had bet that they wouldn't be able to do on-time, on-budget completion. They're now very close to having accomplished on-time, on-budget completion. The next test will be nameplate capacity, meaning after you build the thing, after you pour gold, how long does it take to shake it out before it's producing at capacity? Very recently, I guess as a measure of confidence in on-time, on-budget completion, the company has gone into an arrangement to acquire that portion of the mine from Orion Mine Finance that they didn't own, almost $1 billion expenditure. I think what's ahead of us now in Equinox Gold is having achieved on time, on budget completion, doing so, taking a lot of debt onto the books, and also issuing a reasonable amount of equity for this new acquisition. What does nameplate capacity look like? If they can, within 6 months, achieve the financial parameters that were outlined in the bankable feasibility study, particularly at $2,300 or $2,400 gold, rather than the $1,800 gold used in the study, this stock is going to rock. It's going to absolutely rock. Now, I need to tell people who listen to the first part of this answer that in my 12 prior 10 baggers with Ross Beaty, the median elapsed time is 5.5 or 6 years. And in every single case, I was exposed to a 50% share price decline during some part of the time that I owned the stock. Company building is not stair steps to heaven. And people who own Equinox need to be prepared to have time on their side. And they need to be prepared to stomach volatility. If you are willing to do this, and if you have speculative capital, which is to say capital that you're prepared to lose some of, if I'm wrong, this is a wonderful stock. But otherwise, if you aren't patient, if you aren't tenacious, and if you aren't risk-oriented, don't buy this stock.
Got it. Last one, Avino Silver.
Avino?
Yes.
Avino, I'm not a shareholder of. I've known the company for a very, very, very long time. They have done a reasonably good job eking free cash flow out of an old mine for a very long time. But until they do more exploration work, this one doesn't fit into the potentially big mine scale. There isn't enough data in hand to tell me that the target approaches my target size.
Got it. Recently, and I had the CEO on about a week ago before they were bought out. Aventus Mining was bought out by Silvercorp. Want your thoughts on Silvercorp? Love your thoughts on the management team and love your thoughts on the buyout, on the play.
I was an Aventus shareholder going back a very long time. That company was started by my friends, Brian Dalton. So the provenance there is superb, and the assets are superb. And I think the transaction is good, too. People's problem, I think, with Silvercorp has to do with the fact that the primary producing asset is in China. And that the company's disclosure with regards to reserves and resources has sometimes been somewhat opaque. I suspect that that opaqueness has had to do with dealing with Chinese authorities. But it's important to note that Silvercorp has successfully operated in China for 13 years and has successfully repatriated capital from China. I'm prejudiced here because I was the lead order in taking Silvercorp public many years ago at 35 cents. Now I enjoy annual dividends that exceed 35 cents. So that sort of track record brings a smile to my face. I've known Ray Fang, the CEO of Silvercorp, since before Silvercorp. I've known him for a very, very long time and know him to be a competent human being. Rui is at once a successful financier, a successful explorationist, and a successful mine builder. I think that Aventus could not have found better hands to be in than Silvercorp.
Got it. And I was a shareholder of Aventus as well. Let's here pivot a little bit. Let's talk about copper here. What's interesting to me about copper, well, I was a longer term bull, if you would, starting at the beginning of the year. I just didn't see copper going much cheaper. And now you've had all of this drama recently in Panama, for lack of a better word, I would say. What are your thoughts here moving forward with copper, the copper play? Are we still a little bit too early, or is these mine shutdowns, are they going to have a dramatic impact on the price? And then let's talk about some companies. What are your thoughts?
It wouldn't surprise me if copper has gone too far too fast. Copper went from being a boring topic to being red hot. And normally when things get red hot, they need a pause. I'm not saying it's going to have a pause. I don't think that there's any doubt that we're going to have supply shortfalls in copper in the 5-year time frame. If we have supply shortfalls concurrent with a global worldwide recession, we might not get higher copper prices. You can limit copper supply if you limit copper demand and not have a move in price. So the thesis will really depend on your listeners' thoughts about the economy, the broad economy. And I think their thoughts are probably as good as mine. I don't want to burden them with my macro outlook around the economy. But I do want to burden them with the fact that we have underinvested in copper exploration and underinvested in copper development for three decades. I want to tell people, too, the increasing social rents, taxes, fees, offsite expenses, regulation in important copper-producing countries, including the United States and, more importantly, Chile, are constraining copper development at the same time that we need more copper. This was brought to a head by the annulment by the government of Panama of the right to operate the Cerro Colorado mine, First Quantum had, in Panama. That had a dramatic impact on the share price and market capitalization of both First Quantum and Franco-Nevada. This is an interesting circumstance. This mine, which, by the way, was licensed subject to international arbitration, so the Panamanians are going to be taken to court about this, and not in Panama City, provided about 10% of the foreign exchange receipts enjoyed by the government of Panama, and was a very important source of revenue for the government of Panama. The act to shut it down had nothing at all to do with economics or anything at all to do with the existing fiscal arrangements between First Quantum and the government of Panama. It had all to do with domestic Panamanian politics. First Quantum is pursuing Panama in international arbitration for $10 billion. Unpleasant for Panama because they don't have $10 billion. What this means for the copper business is that an important source, 1.5% of slated global copper production in 2025, has now gone to production heaven. But this isn't the only supply shock that the copper business is seeing. One example, while we're talking about political risk in Panama, is political risk in another third world banana republic called the United States. There's a copper deposit called Resolution that's 1.5 billion tons at 1.5% copper. For reference, that's between 3 and 4 times the average grade of copper deposits worldwide. This wonderful discovery was made 30-something years ago when I was a relatively young man and has now been in excess of 25 years in permitting in Arizona. So when you talk about political risk, you don't have to confine the topic to Congo and Panama and Indonesia. You can think of the political risk inherent in other places like California and Arizona, which are equally pernicious. And that stands between us and having adequate supplies of copper 5 years out. What that means is that existing copper assets that can be ramped up or built reasonably, I think will be extraordinarily valuable things over the next 5 years.
It's funny you bring that up again, because I asked you last time I had you on, it was either the last time or the previous time before that, about what jurisdictions when you touched. You were saying California, and I had another investor and analyst on, and he said the same thing. I would not touch California.
Well, there are others. You know, I'm very loath to invest in British Columbia, absent being in Tahltan territory. If I'm going to invest in British Columbia, I want to invest in traditional third world lands where the local, First Nations land, where the local jurisdiction at least are native bands who I've done business with in the past. So, you know, Nishka, Tahltan, responsible local partners. I'd much rather be regulated in BC and Telegraph Creek than I would in Victoria. So I consider BC to be a risky jurisdiction too.
Interesting. You already talked about First Quantum, so no need to talk more about them, but talk to me about Maduro. What are your thoughts on them?
Maduro.
Yeah, pardon me.
I've got a lot of time for that woman. Teo Dechev is true superstar. She practices the prospect generator business model, where she uses her and her team's technical acumen and specific geographical focus to generate exploration ideas which other people fund. And in her case, the other people are people like Rio, BHP, which is to say large, well-funded, intelligent companies. She's exploring mostly for copper, gold, porphyries, very large deposits. She's exploring in the western part of the Tethyan metallogenic belt, which I think is the best unexplored copper belt in the world. And she's also exploring in the Laramide in southern Arizona. What's unique about Teo is, despite the fact that she doesn't have any revenues from mines, she's cash flow positive from exploration fees, which means that because she brings in joint venture partners for the heavy lifting, she hasn't had to issue equity to keep the company alive and is, in fact, generating surplus cash from exploration. She's done a superb job of keeping the dilution nil or negative while at the same time building up the net asset value of the company. I wouldn't describe this as a copper company so much as an intellectual capital company, a research and development company, if you will, around copper exploration. Disclosure of conflicts of interest. I'm a large shareholder here and a personal fan of this wonderful young technologist.
Excellent. I will probably be a shareholder myself very soon. Last one, Riverside. Talk to me about Riverside.
This is a people story in one sense. I've known Jean-Marc Stouty since he was involved in worldwide exploration, first for BHP and then for Teck. In other words, I've known him long before his junior incarnation. He also practices the prospect generator business model. He's particularly useful because he looks at it from the point of view of the customer, which is to say, although he's an explorationist, he consumed the ideas generated by prospect generators when he worked for BHP and when he worked for Teck. He knows what the majors are looking for because he used to look for it for them. He has not yet enjoyed his exploration success. But again, he hasn't had to dilute. He's made the company succeed without having to issue more shares simply because he used other people's money. And his reputation as an explorationist is so good that he is always able to find major companies who are willing to do the heavy lifting for him. At the same time that he's been very competent in bull markets to take projects that weren't suitable for the majors and package them into Vancouver Stock Exchange ventures, more in a sort of a merchant banking role, building Riverside in some senses the same way that Dave Cole built EMX Royalty, through a combination of prospect generation and merchant banking. Very, very, very successful young guy. Another one where I'm a shareholder, another one where there'll be an exhibitor at our upcoming Natural Resources Investment Symposium.
Got it. Let's close with this. Let's talk about uranium. The last time we'd spoken, you had sold, I don't know how much, but you mentioned that you sold a portion of your uranium investments. This was really at the, I don't know if that was dumb luck, and I say this with all due respect, or just your skill at timing the top of the market. But then uranium, after it settled, it seems to be on a tear again. What are your thoughts here coming into uranium, and what are you looking at?
Well, the two themes there. The first is that I'm a contrarian, and I built a large position in uranium juniors in 2022 when people hated them. There's nothing I love more than hate.
Right.
When the commodity and when the stocks became unhated, when they were uniformly up 300 or 400%, I sold enough to take my risk capital off the table. So now my uranium portfolio stands me at risk nothing. And it's a large portfolio, which is a very good price for a large portfolio. What is really appealing to me about the uranium business is that the structure of the uranium business is changing. And investors don't understand this yet. The part that's changing is that, unlike any other mineral commodity, the structure of the uranium market is going to a term rather than a spot market. In every other commodity that we operate in, mostly the buying and selling takes place second by second. So there's no real way of forecasting price accurately. In uranium, because the market is so constrained, increasingly what you see is contractual relationships between buyers and sellers that last for 15 years. Up to 15 years. They can be 5, they can be 10, but up to 15 years, which means that from the seller's point of view, you get some certainty, both with regards to the amount of material you'll be able to sell, but more importantly, what you'll be able to sell it for. And so doing forecasts around top-line sales and even around margin becomes easier in the uranium business than in any other mineral commodity in the world. What that means is that if you're a junior going to build a uranium mine, without having recourse to a big, stout, major company balance sheet, 3 years ago when uranium was priced in the spot market, you couldn't do it. But now, as that uranium junior, if you can lock in a fixed price for 15 years for 60 or 70% of your production, so that the bank can see that you can amortize your loan with sales to an investment-grade quality credit, a Tokyo Electric Power, a China General Nuclear, a Southern Company, an Ontario Power. You can finance these things, and you can finance them at a lower cost of capital than other people can do. Similarly, if you're a securities analyst, if you're an old, fat, bald, green eye shade loan shark like Rick Rule, trying to figure out what the company's worth, when you have some certainty as to how much product you can sell and what price you can sell it for, rather than relying on unreliable forecasts of future pricing, it makes understanding the value proposition much, much, much easier. The consequence of that is that in the uranium business, while the easy money has been made, when you go from completely hated to tolerated and then liked, and when you take the commodity price from $20 a pound to $100 a pound, okay, the easy money has been made. What's unique about the uranium business is that the sure money is in front of us. Now, there are probably 85 companies that purport to be in the uranium space. Most of them are populated by the lame, the halt, and the blind. The only uranium they have is on the heading of a share certificate. But there are 12 or 13 or 14 companies for whom this transition from spot to term becomes incredibly important. And I think that's really the theme in front of us. Stock picking in the uranium business and paying really strict attention to whatever information you can glean, despite the fact that it's opaque information around these term contracts, is the key to making really delightful amounts of money in the uranium space over the next 5 years.
On that note, what do you think of the royalty companies?
Well, the royalty business is the best business around mining that exists. A royalty, for those of your listeners who don't know, is an interest in the revenue stream from a project without having an interest in the capital cost or the operating expense, which is to say your gross is your net. This is a very good business. It gives you access to commodity price upside. It gives you access to a positive reconciliation with regards to reserve and resource, but it doesn't expose you to operating cost surprises or capital cost liabilities. I absolutely love the royalty business. I would suggest, and I have employed back when I was responsible for other people's financial futures, I have constructed natural resource portfolios that were entirely composed of royalty and streaming companies for those customers who wanted upside associated with the resource thesis, but didn't want to take operating risk. And I think a case can be made for many investors who want to be a little more passive that they overemphasize royalty and streaming companies in their portfolio.
So I'm an investor in royalty companies. I'm actually getting my dear old mother in as an investor in royalty companies because she wants exposure to the commodities. And I'm trying to find the downside, if you would, of a royalty company. That's what I'm having trouble. That's a good problem to have, but that's what I'm
I think there's two downsides. I think some royalty companies, because of the success the sector has enjoyed, trade at too high a price relative to net asset value. When you are buying a royalty for more than the royalty is worth at current commodity prices, you have to believe that A, commodity prices are going to go up. You have to be buying some optionality. And you have to believe that exploration development will increase the value of the royalty. Now, this is not a bad bet if the royalties are on very large projects. I would point out as an example that Franco-Nevada's royalty on the Barrick lands in northern Nevada were purchased for, if my memory serves me correctly, $2 million US and have now generated $1.15 billion US while at the same time replacing the reserves that they mined, which means they started with a certain reserve number. They produced that reserve number, but exploration has replaced those reserves. The point here is that very large deposits always yield you surprises, and those surprises are almost always good. The other risk you have is in the very small subscale royalty companies, where they don't have durable competitive advantages over their larger competitors in terms of cost of capital, and where the costs associated with being a public company are too high relative to the royalty portfolios. In this circumstance, you need to buy nascent small royalty companies where you believe they have some durable competitive advantage that will give them the ability to acquire royalties at a reasonable enough cost of capital and at a reasonable enough pace to amortize the public company expense. Me Too royalty companies, third tier Me Too royalty companies, are an absolute positive dead end. If you're buying companies that are subscale, and I own a couple of them, you're buying them because you believe that the management team has some durable competitive advantage in the space that will allow them to achieve scale and lower their cost of capital relative to their competitors.
Got it. Well, Rick, I'm going to see you down in Boca Raton. Tell me about what's going to happen in July in Boca Raton. I'd love to our listeners to share.
Well, I want to talk to you, if I'm allowed to, about my whole value proposition. If you like the way I think and you like my rankings, you can access it for free. Go to ruralinvestmentmedia.com, list your natural resource stocks. I'll rank them personally, 1 to 10. I'll rank them for free. Why do I do that? Because after I've ranked them for free, I want to sell you some things. I want you to come to my boot camps, 8-hour-long sessions every 3 months where we do a deep dive on some topic. We've done royalty and streaming. We've done silver. We've done uranium. Very well timed, by the way. The next one we're going to do is about private placement. So we want to see you there. The granddaddy of our paid events, though, is the Natural Resources Investment Symposium. This year, July 7 through 11 in Boca Raton, Florida. I'm delighted, by the way, Andy, that you're coming. This is my highest value effort. What does that look like? Well, first of all, we bring great big picture thinkers. You know, the Jim Rickards of the world, the Bill Bonners of the world, the Nomi Prins of the world, the Daniela DiMartina Booths of the world. People who tell you about the world in terms of macro the way it is, not the way that CNBC wishes it were. But we go beyond macro. Macro is just to set the stage. We go to micro. We have great portfolio managers. We have great analysts, people who have made money in resources for 30 years, not failed investment bankers who blew out a supermarket portfolio or a financial services portfolio and have parachuted into mining where they can't do any damage. But I'm talking about people who've been really successful. But beyond that, our best feature, I think, is we have the living legends. We have a group of people who have built multi-billion dollar mining companies from scratch, not beating their chest, well, maybe a little of that, but really telling you how they did it and telling you how that path made them better investors and can make you a better investor too. So the Robert Friedlands of the world, the Bob Quartermains of the world, the Ross Beatties of the world, the Sean Rosens of the world, the Randy Smallwoods of the world, they're all going to be there. By the way, I had a guy email me years ago saying, following Robert Friedland around the exhibit floor, seeing what booths he stopped in front of and lurking and listening to what questions he asked was worth more than the cost of admission. I got the whole rest of the conference for free. But let's move on with the value proposition. Every public company exhibitor at our conference is owned in accounts owned or managed by me, which is to say every single exhibitor is vetted. At every other investment conference I know, the qualification to be an exhibitor is a check that cashes. That's it. No guarantee because I own a stock it goes up, but there is a guarantee, believe me, that I've looked very, very, very closely. These are all vetted. Now, the upshot of all this is that any educational product that I sell, be it the boot camp, be it the paid interviews, be it the Natural Resources Investment Symposium, comes with a gold-plated money-back guarantee. If you come physically to Boca Raton, which is what I would prefer, or if you attend in the comfort and convenience of your own home via live stream, if you don't believe for any reason that I haven't delivered value for money, email me and I'll give you your money back. No questions asked. I would prefer, if I fail, that you tell me how I fail, but that's not a requirement. We've had money back guarantees on our investment educational products for 30 years, and I'm delighted to say that we've delivered enough value for our attendees that we've had to refund less than 0.1% of the tuitions that we've received. But that notwithstanding, no other investment conference in the world I know of has an absolute unequivocal money-back guarantee. That's the best guarantee you have that we deliver value for money.
About that, it was 1994, Rick. I was at an investment conference. I met you, spoke very briefly, and then I followed you around the investment conference talking to all the companies. And yes, I made a lot of money.
That's a technique, just so you know, that I did in the early part of the decade of the 70s. I mean, we all learn from mentors, right? Now, 50 years later, I am one.
You're my mentor at that. Rick, I can't thank you so much for just your time. I am utterly grateful. And again, as I mentioned to you offline, I've been looking forward to this all week. So I'm also looking forward to seeing you in Florida. And maybe I'll talk with you before then, but seeing you in Florida and spending a lot of time with you in Florida.
Well, I look forward to both. I'm happy to do these interviews, given how hard you worked before them, at any time you'd like. And I'm absolutely delighted that I'll be seeing you in Boca. I hope I see a lot of your listeners there. If they can't come, I would encourage them, of course, to attend via live stream. By the way, whether you attend live or live stream, we're going to give you 50 hours of intense programming in 4 days. There's no way on earth you're going to absorb it all. The consequence of that is that the recordings will be available to you for a year. And to get full value out of the conference, you will have to refer to the recordings several times. I put on the conference, and I have to refer to the recordings.
All right. Well, thanks again, Rick. Well, I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
You bet.